Hello and welcome to the Cottage Punk Podcast. This is Hot Off the Press. I'm Andrea Richjord, and with me is Andrew Pillamai. Today is June 11th, 2018. What are you going to talk about today, Andrew?
So today I'm going to be talking about communicating with aliens and all of the philosophy and linguistics that go around alien language, quote unquote.
Alien language?
Yeah, alien language. And then I'm also going to be talking about an invasive species of toad that has been found in Madagascar, as well as places like Papua New Guinea, India, etc. How about you?
We have some similar topics, because I'm going to talk about an asteroid that hit on June 2nd.
Nice.
And I'm also going to talk about...
amphibians?
Bees.
Oh, bees, okay.
Because I love my bees.
You do love bees.
But I'm going to talk about wild bees versus cultivated bees.
Okay.
Sort of. You will find out.
That sounds cool. So should we start with aliens? Because I love
Let's
aliens.
Let's start with some space stuff, because we've been talking about space a lot. Let's keep it rolling.
Yeah, for sure. So there was recently a conference in Los Angeles by the U.S. National Space Society, which is essentially a big group of both space enthusiasts as well as scientists and engineers who all want to sort of congregate in the same area and talk about space. Mm-hmm. And at this conference, there was a group called the Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence Committee, or for short, METI.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, their meetings and their convention is all about how do we talk or how do we communicate to any potential intelligence that's out there in the universe? Like, do we send them music, or do we send them recordings of our voices, or what do we send them in order for them to understand us? Which is kind of cool, right?
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting concept, because we haven't received anything like that from any other life forms in the universe.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I'm curious about what that means.
Obviously, there hasn't been any confirmation of extraterrestrial life out there other than ourselves.
Right.
So, what...
we aren't extraterrestrial.
Yeah, correct. Now, there's obviously a lot of problems with trying to communicate with aliens. First of all, we have no idea if there's anyone even out there.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, we don't understand what they understand. And third of all, if you look at the Earth, there's a lot of animals and there's a lot of species, even just on this planet, and we have a difficult time communicating with any of them even.
Yeah.
So who's to say we would be able to communicate with an alien that's hundreds of light years away, if not thousands? It seems like a pretty slim chance of being able to communicate.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what this group is based around. And one of their hypotheses is that we could use mathematics to communicate. Because if there's a species out there, or an organism that has the ability to pick up our signals and our messages,
mm-hmm.
then they must at least have some similar grasp on mathematics and science. So if we send them messages containing mathematics, they'll be able to understand us as being intelligent beings.
Or they have a completely different, what if they don't have math?
Yeah, you kind of have to assume that mathematics is a universal language. Now, there's actually been quite a bit of study within linguistics, and Noam Chomsky in the mid-80s actually came up with this theory of universal grammar. So things within our own language that are universal and belong to all language.
Hmm.
And to sum it up, he said there's kind of like two parts to language. There's the subject and then there's modifiers. But it's kind of hard to argue that you could use this framework to talk to aliens. So some people have proposed we use music, since music applies mathematics to a more emotionally based or a more human based
field. Well, what we see as human, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
My question, like, this makes me think of, like, that's cool that we're sending music out to the world, but, like, what music do you choose to represent mankind? And then who's deciding that?
Exactly.
Why are they deciding that? And then what if there are really intelligent aliens out there who don't have hearing? Like, as...
that don't use sound?
Yeah, what if they don't use sound as a form of communication?
Or as a sense at all?
Yeah.
So, that is a really good question. I have no idea. Like, should we be sending images? Should we be sending sense? Who knows?
Yeah.
Now, in 1973, there was a satellite called the Pioneer that was sent out past our solar system.
Like, and past Pluto and stuff?
Yep. And it contains a pictorial message named Pioneer Plaque, which is this big metal plaque that has a diagram of our solar system,
mm-hmm.
as well as its location in our local group, as well as a picture of a white male and a white female. So obviously,
a white male and a white female.
Correct. So obviously there's been debate as to, like, whether this is a justifiable representation of humankind.
No.
As well as whether it's even safe to be sending out a location into the universe. Now, one of the things that Stephen Hawking was very adamant about before passing away,
mm-hmm.
rest in peace,
yeah,
was that the last thing we should be doing is trying to contact aliens. Because if we look at invasions of other communities in our own history, it's never good news. If you look at, like, the Aztec Empire, the introduction of Europeans was devastating. Both the amount of, like, violence inflicted on the Aztec was horrendous, as well as the diseases that the Europeans carried
mm-hmm.
were detrimental to the Aztec people. So if an alien understands that we exist in our solar system and they come to visit us, who knows what diseases or viruses they might carry with them?
Yeah, they could wipe out every living thing on the planet.
Exactly.
Or we could wipe out their entire species.
Oh, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about this sort of stuff. One of my favorite conspiracy theories about this, obviously not fact-based, is that there's a committee, like a universe committee, mm-hmm. that sees our Earth as, like, a conservation land.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like against galaxy law to contact us or interact with us, because we're kind of like an uncontacted species.
That's kind of an interesting concept.
Yeah, science fiction has played around with this concept a lot.
Yeah, I can see. I mean, if anyone out there has seen Doctor Who, I want to say it's the episode, I think it's the Christmas episode when David Tennant just is starting off.
Oh my God, I love David Tennant.
I love David Tennant too.
Oh.
It's the one where he grows his hand back. And in that scenario, these aliens come to Earth because we've sent stuff out there.
Ooh,
and
big no-no.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So going from extraterrestrial beings to extraterrestrial rocks, you said there was an asteroid landing?
Yeah, so there was an asteroid that hit somewhere in southern Africa.
Oh, cool.
So I read this information on, like, the 5th. And then I double-checked it on, like, the 7th. And so, since then, there may have been a little bit more information found. But, basically, on June 2nd, an asteroid broke through the atmosphere and sort of exploded over southern Africa. And they've pinpointed, cool. because it was, like, viewed by a lot of people. There's actually some kind of cool video out there that you can see of it actually, like, breaking through the atmosphere. It's like a big fiery comet and then, like, an explosion of light. Apparently, there's no sound in the videos, but apparently it was really loud.
Well, we should link that in the
post. We will link it in the post.
Yeah, we definitely will.
But a lot of the sightings were from people living in South Africa. Mm. But they think that the location was more... Botswana and the border between Botswana and Namibia. So this...
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah. So it's cool because there are like hundreds of near-Earth space objects, but most of them, when they hit the atmosphere, evaporate or disintegrate, or they don't even hit us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of rare when one actually breaks through. And there are tons of space agencies or like...
sort of groups.
Yeah, groups, like universities, oh my gosh, astronomy. I could not think of that word. Astronomy departments and things like that that are keeping track of all these near-Earth objects. And so usually we know about it beforehand. But there's this one dude named Richard Kowalski. He works for the Catalina Sky Survey. It's in near Tucson in Arizona. And he has discovered three asteroids that have actually hit Earth, and he's discovered them like mere hours before they've actually impacted us.
Whoa. So is he an amateur astronomer?
No, he works for the Sky Survey.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I think it's like through Arizona. ASU? I think it's ASU or Arizona University. It's through University in Arizona.
Awesome.
So it's not, he's not like just some guy. He's like a senior.
He works for an institution.
Yeah. He is. Very cool. Yeah, he's like a senior
researcher
or something. But that's kind of crazy to think about. Like,
that's
it was
insane.
Discovered, and 2 hours later, it actually impacted the Earth.
Impact. That's awesome. So now that asteroid is a meteorite.
Now it's a meteorite, and it's many meteorites, probably.
Many
There's a little bit of debate on whether it actually, like...
Made contact?
Well, it made contact, but there's debate on whether there's actually meteorites that to be found or not. Because I read an account that said that if you find meteorites, contact this number, blah, 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 because... The sooner you find it, the better, like, study subject it is. Because it's, like, fresher and it's had less time in our atmosphere and all that stuff.
Ah, I see.
But then I read another account that said that it would have disintegrated and there wouldn't be any meteorites.
Like it was too small.
Yeah. Perhaps. So we'll see. But one thing that's interesting that I hadn't really thought about before that I read in one of these articles is that there... is very few of the few asteroids that actually hit Earth. There's even fewer that we find because 71% of our planet is water.
And
so
obviously
they all end up in the ocean pretty much. So it's kind of a big deal when you actually are living through a moment where an asteroid hits Earth.
Without a doubt.
So that's pretty cool.
That's so awesome. Well, I think that wraps up our first two topics. Be sure to stick around for after the break, and we'll be back in a few. Hello, thank you for sticking around, and welcome back to Hot Off the Press. So, last time I started off with a topic, and I think this time we should start with one of yours. So, what's your topic about, Andrea?
So, my topic is about managed bees and wild bees. And are the managed bees outcompeting the wild bees?
Now, what do you mean when you say managed bees?
When I say managed bees, I mean like the bees that a beekeeper has. The bees that are kept by a beekeeper.
Now, is it appropriate to say those are domesticated bees?
I wouldn't use the word domesticated. I think that a lot of people would. I wouldn't because you're not... The bees aren't doing what you want them to do,
they're
necessarily.
Just doing
it's not like you're
thing.
Telling them to do something and they're doing it. You're just providing. You're providing a home for them, and you're taking care of them and stuff. So
gotcha.
I would say managed, cultivated.
Yeah,
you could use the word domestic.
Nice. So the topic is whether they're outcompeting local bees, right?
Yeah, so the issue is that bees are used for 45% of the most common crops in the US and in most of Europe.
Wow.
And bees the way that they're used for that, it's not just wild bees pollinating these crop fields. Bees are actually, their hives are brought from like a beekeeper's. So beekeepers are kind of like farmers. There's hobbyists, and then there's people who work for a company or a corporation. So the corporation beekeepers are used to help pollinate the 45% of the crops. So
there's companies that distribute beehives,
yep,
like around the country.
Yeah. So
that is insane.
Yeah. So they go to, like, so almonds, for example, have to be pollinated by usually bees, but by pollinators.
Right.
So what would happen is the, I'm just going to call it the Beekeepers Association for now, would take their hive, mm-hmm, to the grove of almond trees at the right time of year. The bees would come out, they would pollinate. When the pollination season is up, the Beekeepers Association would take the hive back. I assume that they take the hive back. Okay. I haven't done research on that for sure. But that's right. What they bring the bees to pollinate specifically, and then they, that's the whole
and
point.
Then they're rowdy.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So is there any potential for these cultivated or these managed bees to crossbreed with wild bees?
No. And the reason is because queen bees, if you've ever heard of the virgin flight, like you, people, mm-hmm, say it with like airplanes, it's like the first flight of the airplane is the virgin flight, but it comes from bees. So queen bees are virgin until they take their virgin flight. And basically the point of a virgin flight of the queen bee is to mate with as many drones as possible. So she basically flies out, mates with as many drones as possible, and then comes back to the hive and never mates again. So she stores all of the eggs in that she will ever lay in her whole life in her body.
Oh,
for
my
goodness. Yeah.
For the whole life. Hive.
Yeah.
How long do they live for, these queen bees?
I don't know for sure. And it usually depends on like the health of the hive and stuff. But I think a couple
and, like,
of years.
The species and stuff. Mm-hmm.
It also depends on how big the hive is. Because if the hive gets really big, they, the workers will create a new queen cell. So all bees start as the same egg,
mm-hmm,
and they become a worker bee or a queen cell bee or a drone based on how the workers treat the egg.
Whoa.
So royal jelly is the food that they feed the egg that they want to become a queen.
Right.
And then, so that egg would develop into a queen bee. You call it a queen cell. Because,
oh my goodness,
the cell of the honeycomb. So honeycomb is like, yeah, all these little hexagonal cells. And sometimes there's honey inside, and sometimes there's what you call brood inside. And that's all eggs.
Oh, okay.
So the queen cells look different. They kind of look like peanuts in the shell. They're much larger. Whoa. And it's because the workers have like helped this,
yeah,
this little bee become a new queen. And so when a new queen comes along,
mm-hmm,
either one of two things will happen. Either the new queen will fight with the old queen and kill her and take over the hive,
mm-hmm,
or the new queen will fly away and some of the worker bees and drones will follow her and they'll create their own hive. That's usually what like a swarm is.
Oh my god.
Sometimes swarms are like whole hives worth of bees that are trying to find a new home. And sometimes a swarm is like when there's a new queen and she's leaving and it's her sex. It's like all her people are coming with her.
Whoa. So the sex of the bee is essentially determined by external factors.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely wild.
Yeah. It's so cool and I could talk about it forever, but that's not what the actual article is. So
okay,
I'm gonna hone back in on this.
So who's winning the competition?
Basically, honeybees are winning the competition. And the competition is over the flower resources. So flowers for bees is food.
Mm-hmm.
That's why bees pollinate. They don't pollinate because they want to pollinate. They pollinate because they're looking for food, and it happens to be a byproduct of that action.
Gotcha.
So the flower sources for both the honeybees that have come in and the wild bees is a food source that they're both competing for. And who do you think has a better chance of survival in this competition? The wild bees that are out there making their own hives, surviving against predators on their own and the weather and like things like varroa mites or diseases that these bees might have completely on their own, or the honeybees that are in a man-made hive and are being taken care of all the time, make sure that their diseases aren't getting too bad and keeping things like bears and like spiders and praying mantis out of the hive that will be harmful to them. The managed honeybees are gonna be they're way better off. So this is the issue, that you bring managed honeybees into an environment that already has an endangered wild bee population, not only because all of the factors I already mentioned, but also because of stressors put on to them by humans, things like pollution, things like
global climate change,
things like encroachment on their territory by housing units and things like that.
Oh, so that sounds rough.
Yeah, so wild honeybees or wild bees in general are not doing so hot.
Oh, poor guys.
Yeah, so I mean that's part of the whole pollinator protection.
Interesting.
Everything.
Now that seems like a trend amongst all domesticated breeds. Like if we look at domesticated grazers within a certain prairie, though almost 100% of the time those domesticated breeds are going to outcompete the wild breeds.
And it's usually because instead of natural, in my opinion, I don't know this if as fact, but I think that it's probably because instead of natural selection selecting the best, like survival of the fittest situation, humans are specifically breeding these animals for certain purposes.
That's a good hypothesis.
And that's going at a faster rate than the natural selection would.
Oh, wow. So, moving on from bees to another potentially invasive species, Madagascar has been under some extreme heat by a small little dude called the Asian common toad. And the Latin name for the Asian common toad is the Deuterophanus melanosticticus.
Which is a mouthful.
That is definitely a mouthful. And the reason this Asian common toad is such an issue in Madagascar is because, A, there's not really a whole lot of toads in Madagascar to begin with. And B, the Asian common toad specifically is poisonous to most creatures that eat it.
So you wouldn't want a mouthful of that.
Oh, you definitely don't want a mouthful of Asian common toad. So a group from University of California, Berkeley, has been looking at the DNA sequence of 88 native species in Madagascar that would potentially interact with this Asian common toad. And what they've been finding is that only one of the 88 tested species is immune to the poison within the Asian common toad.
That's not good. So this little guy could potentially like wipe out an entire like species of animal on Madagascar?
Now, potentially. So Madagascar has been biologically separated and isolated from the rest of the world for about 80-90 million years.
Whoa.
So the biosphere that we're seeing within Madagascar is completely unique to that island, and we can't see it anywhere else in the world. And that also means that its biodiversity is also really sensitive to external influences or introduced species. The Asian common toad being one of them.
Rot-row.
Yeah, rot-row is right. So there's only kind of one other toad that's anywhere near as invasive as the Asian common toad, and that's the cane toad. And the cane toad has heavily impacted the biodiversity of places such as Fiji, Australia, I believe New Zealand as well.
Yeah.
And the Asian common toad was introduced to Madagascar through shipping and trade, or at least that's what's believed, is that it kind of hitchhiked on ships or within parcels or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more often than not the way that animals are introduced into new areas, mm-hmm. is by hitchhiking on human vessels. So currently researchers are trying to figure out the full impact of the Asian common toad, or its maximum potential of influence.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also trying to figure out ways that we can sort of negate that influence. And there's a lot of things we could do, and who knows exactly which of those options would actually do anything. It's kind of hard to eradicate the Asian common toad, and obviously you can't tell a wild species what not to eat. It's right. Not like you can put up signs of, hey, by the way, don't eat this, dude, because it's poisonous.
Do you think that, like, are the people on Madagascar just, like, when they find them, collecting them and disposing of them in some way so that a creature doesn't eat them? Or, like, possibly reporting it to authorities, and then, I mean, like, what are authorities going to do either?
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely do that. We see a similar thing happening in Minnesota with the zebra mussels, mm. where a lot of local people will try their best to eradicate them,
mm-hmm.
but you're kind of competing and fighting against the force of nature, and these species yeah. will find a way to outcompete our efforts. And it's also important to note there's a big difference between an invasive species as well as a migrated species.
Right, because I was just thinking, like, basically anything could be considered an invasive species.
Yeah, definitely.
Depending on the time period in which you're talking about.
Yeah, certainly. Now, here's a big difference that I've understood, is that a migrated species, such as, let's say, South Dakota and the Black Hills.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Hills are notoriously known for their big, dark, brooming pine trees. And these black pine trees are sort of what give the Black Hills their name, right? That's what they're recognized for.
Mm-hmm.
However, recent forest fires and recent changes in climate change have caused the Black Hills to be introduced with more birch trees than pine trees. And this isn't seen as an invasive species, since this is a natural occurrence and this is a natural introduction of birch trees.
Right.
Versus the introduction of, say,
like kudzu in the south.
Yeah, exactly. Or bamboo in Georgia. Clearly that mm-hmm. bamboo isn't supposed to be there and wouldn't be there without anthropogenic influences.
Mm-hmm. And then it just, like, takes over. It's not like yeah. the forests are gradually becoming more bamboo because of natural causes. They're gradually becoming bamboo because bamboo grows hella fast.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at invasive species, A, it's usually caused by humans, and B, it happens over a scale that's much faster than natural species migrations.
Mm-hmm.
And so the local biodiversity doesn't have time to adapt and adjust to this introduction.
Gotcha.
So it's definitely possible you could have a natural migration of bamboo into Georgia without humans, but it would happen over a much longer period of time, and the local biodiversity would have time to catch up to it.
Gotcha.
And I think that's all I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, that's all I have for this week.
So I guess at the end of this, I kind of just want to quickly talk about what happened at Artawil.
Oh, yeah.
So about a month ago, Cottage Punk had a booth at a local art festival, let's say, that's called Artawil. And we got a lot of people coming to the booth and were very interested in the sorts of things that we're doing. And if you happen to be one of the people at that booth and you're listening to our podcast now, hello and welcome.
Yay.
And we were also raising money for a local charity that is called the Phillips Indian Educators, or PIE for short. And we managed to successfully raise over $100 for PIE. So round of applause, yay.
So basically, we were selling stickers with our logo on it. We were also selling hand-printed journals that have the logo on it, as well as bookmarks. So the bookmarks were block printed. Andrew designed the front and I did the printing. And then PI helps Indigenous students in the academic system to succeed, basically.
Yeah, they're a great educational group that is really doing some substantial stuff. I highly suggest you go and check out their website. I highly suggest you give them your patronage, because they can definitely do with all the help they can get. So, if you're interested further in Cottage Punk, be sure to check us out on Instagram, Facebook,
and the web.
And you can find us at any of those places under Cottage Punk. Pretty easy to remember. And that's everything from me.
That's it. So, until next time, guys.
Farewell all.